Let's return again to those examples of vision, mineral exploration, medical imaging, and integration. As I've already noted, the information is partial and contaminated. But there's one more important property we haven't mentioned. Information costs. For example, in mineral exploration, a seismologist might set off explosions whose effect is measured by sensors. That's an expensive process. So there's the third assumption. Information costs. These three assumptions are fundamental. Information is partial, information is contaminated, information costs. Let me contrast that with the usual assumptions concerning the traveling salesman problem. The available information there specifies just one task. That is, all the intercity distances are given, therefore information is complete. Furthermore, the intercity distances are assumed to be given without error. Therefore, the information is exact. Finally, the intercity distances are provided without charge. Thus, the information is free. For the traveling salesman problem, then, information is assumed to be complete, exact, and it's free. These assumptions are also made for many other important problems, for example, the NP complete problems that I mentioned earlier. Thus, computational complexity comes in two flavors, depending on which set of assumptions you want to make about the information. Is the information complete, exact, and free, as with the traveling salesman problem? Or is the information partial, contaminated, and priced, as with a host of other real-world problems? For the rest of the lecture, I'm going to assume that information is partial, contaminated, and that it costs. That's the province of information-based complexity. I'd like to pose six of the questions that we address in information-based complexity. Question one. What is the intrinsic uncertainty in the solution of a problem due to the available information? The intrinsic uncertainty. No matter what you do, what is the intrinsic uncertainty? Question two. How much information is needed to limit the uncertainty to a specified level? For example, in geophysical exploration, how many measurements must the seismologist make if he wants to guarantee a certain quality of answer? Question three, what's the optimal information? Again, using our geophysical exploration example, where on the Earth's surface should the seismologist place his instruments? Question four, can the information be decomposed for parallel or distributed computation? Question five, what is the optimal algorithm for solving a given problem? Question six, what is the computational complexity of solving a problem for a given level of uncertainty? Now you'll note that those questions fall naturally into two groups. The first four questions all have to do with the quantity and the quality of the information. They concern the intrinsic uncertainty due to the available information, the amount of information to achieve specified uncertainty, optimal information, and decomposition of information. I didn't mention algorithm, and I didn't mention complexity. That's because those first four questions are all at the information level. It is information level considerations that give information-based complexity its perspective and its power. The information level doesn't exist for the traveling salesman problem because it has complete and exact information. The last two of our six questions do indeed have to do with algorithms. They concern the optimal algorithm and the cost of the optimal algorithm, that is, the computational complexity of the problem. So those two questions are at the algorithm level. Again, I emphasize that's the only level that exists for problems such as NP-complete problems which have complete and exact information. The advantage of working at the information level is that it is essentially independent of the model of computation. Recall that by model of computation I meant what is allowed, how much does it cost. Speaking technically for just a moment, there is a model at the information level. It is what computer scientists call an oracle model. But an oracle model is extremely weak and extremely non-restrictive. At the algorithm level, the results of information-based complexity are dependent on the model of computation. And since for problems with complete and exact information, there is nothing but the algorithm level, the model of computation plays a very important role in that domain. You must specify the model, and much depends on that model. To give you some further idea of what we can do with the power of information-based complexity, I'm going to discuss results concerning two of the questions. I'm going to discuss questions 1 and question 4. The first question, you'll recall, was what is the intrinsic uncertainty in the solution of a problem due to the available information? There exists a quantity which measures this intrinsic uncertainty. It's called the radius of information, and it is fundamental not only to answering that first question, but also to answering some of the other questions I posed. To emphasize this, I'll state the information principle. There exists a quantity called the radius of information, which measures the intrinsic uncertainty of solving a problem for specified information. The relation between intrinsic uncertainty and radius of information is obtained using a technique called an adversary argument. The use of this technique for information-based complexity was pioneered by Shmuel Winograd of IBM Research and by Henrik Wojnarowski. Now, we can measure the uncertainty in various ways. We can measure it in a worst-case model. Worst-case is also called minimax, because one wants to minimize the error for the maximally difficult problem instance. Worst-case analysis is appropriate for the design of commercial aircraft and nuclear power plants. For other types of problems, however, the results are often too pessimistic, and therefore much of our work, especially these days, is on average case models. Let me turn now to question 4. The fourth question was, can the information be decomposed for parallel or distributed computation? As a background to this question, I'll tell you briefly about an important trend in computer architecture and computer networks. In the 50s and 60s, a computer had a single processor, and computers weren't connected with each other. Computing was sequential. Two trends started in the late 60s, which are accelerating today. First, we harness many processors together in a single computer. This is called parallel computation and is one of the means by which we speed up calculation. You've been reading about supercomputers in newspapers and periodicals. Parallel computation is one of the ways in which supercomputers solve problems faster. And secondly, we harness computers together into computer networks, either so that the computers can work together to solve a problem faster, of course, or because the data of the problem are distributed, and therefore we want to distribute the computing power to where the data are. So we live in an era of parallel and distributed computing, as contrasted with the days when we computed sequentially. New technology means new challenges. On these new systems, the old sequential algorithms may not be effective. We have to rethink how to solve problems. Now, one important way to to deal with solving problems on parallel or distributed systems is to decompose the problem. That will be a subject for investigation as far ahead as I can see. I might point out parenthetically that when Wozniak, the creative force behind Apple Computer, was asked to predict what would happen in personal computers in 18 months, he said, 18 months? I don't even know what's going to happen in 6 months. In particular, can the task of obtaining the information be decomposed? Thus, the motivation of our fourth question, whether the information can be decomposed for parallel computation. And I want to tell you about some recent results. And I'm going to use a simplified version of a game you're all familiar with, the game of 20 questions, to illustrate the difference between parallel and sequential information. You tell me, I'm thinking of a number from 1 to 16. My job is to find out what number you're thinking of, asking you as few questions as possible, and you're just going to give me yes and no answers. You all know the game. Say you're thinking of 11. The sequence of questions and answers might be as follows. Is the number between 1 and 8? No, you'd say. Is the number between 9 and 12? Yes. Is the number between 9 and 10? No. Is the answer 11? Yes. I obtained your number with four questions, and that's no accident. It's well known that one of 16 possibilities can always be identified with four questions answered by yes or no. The questions I asked you were sequential, because I waited for your answer to each question and then asked you the next question. That's an example of sequential information. I could equivalently refer to the questions as being adaptive, because I waited for your answer to each question and then adapted my next question to your answer. The phrases sequential information and adaptive information are used synonymously. Now, even though you could have been thinking of any one of 16 numbers, I obtained your number with just four questions, four adaptive questions. And that shows the power of adaption. Or does it? It turns out that four questions asked simultaneously, that is, in parallel, would have done it also. Four simultaneous questions would have also isolated your number. I'm going to leave it as an exercise to the listener to see which four parallel questions should be asked. So for this little game, adaption does not reduce the number of questions. It's got nothing to do with adaption. While you're thinking about that, I'll have a sip of water. Well, who cares? Assume it takes one unit of time to ask about membership in a set and to obtain an answer. Four questions asked sequentially, adaptively, therefore cost four units of time. But four questions asked simultaneously, that is, in parallel, can be answered in one unit of time, provided, of course, that I have four processors to answer the questions. The speed-up, therefore, is the same as the number of processors. I can solve my problem. If I have n processors, I can solve my problem n times as fast. And since processors, as you all know, are dirt cheap these days, that's a very attractive result. Now, although this version of 20 questions that we've just played is a very simple game, it contains the kernel of what is involved in disease diagnosis and drug therapy. For 20 questions, a small insight is sufficient to see that adaption can't help. I'm now going to turn to an area where resolving whether adaption helps is far more subtle. I'm going to return to the question discussed earlier of estimating the value of an integral. geometrically, what am I doing? I'm estimating the area under a curve where the curve is specified by the integrand. Imagine now that we've evaluated the integrand at a number of points, and that therefore we have some idea of the shape of the curve. How are you going to take advantage of that knowledge to choose the next point for evaluation? For example, should you evaluate the integrand where the slope is large? So that's where the shape is changing most rapidly. Now, the strategy where you gather information and then decide where to evaluate next is, of course, sequential or adaptive. Parallel information, on the contrary, although very desirable for parallel computation, means we have got to decide in advance where all the evaluations are to be taken without having any opportunity to take advantage of what we learned about the shape of the curve as we were proceeding. And intuition suggests that adaption should be very helpful. But adaption is misleading. Adaption cannot help for integration. It doesn't help for the worst case. It doesn't help on the average. It doesn't help for the stochastic case where the integrand values have random errors. Now, that wouldn't be very interesting if that were a property of integration. But adaption doesn't help for the example I described earlier, the example of estimating the shape of an object, such as the hood of an automobile. And if adaption doesn't help, that's very good news, because it means that the information can be obtained in parallel, we can benefit by parallel or distributed computation. And I'd like to congratulate all of you. You have very smart eyes, because you knew that. I've got to emphasize there are, of course, many problems for which adaption helps. We have, however, identified many important problems for which we can prove adaption cannot help. Now, if I might be permitted to assess the significance of these results on the power of adaptive information, I believe the value of the approach is not in the results themselves, although they're satisfying. The significance is that we can establish these results in a very general framework so they can be widely applied. And indeed, if I can be technical for just a moment, what really matters is that the problem is specified by a linear operator, and that in the average case models, the distribution of problem instances is governed by a measure with a certain symmetry property, such as, for example, a Gaussian or Wiener measure. The general results are due in large part to the work of my colleagues, Greg Wasilkowski and Henrik Wojniakowski. And furthermore, those results aren't obvious, and indeed they run counter to the beliefs of many practitioners. Before leaving the topic of distributed computation, I want to mention a very interesting connection to what might seem like a totally different question. How does a decentralized economic system, such as the one we have in the United States, do its job? Some of our leading economists, including Kenneth Arrow, Gerald de Breuer, and Leo Hurwitz, have studied such issues as resource allocation in decentralized economies. My colleagues and I think there are interesting connections between distributed computation and informational economics, and are investigating this area jointly with a number of economists. Now, our accomplishments in information-based complexity to date may be separated into two parts: general theoretical results and applications of the theory to various disciplines. I indicated some of the theoretical results earlier. The radius of information has been identified as a quantity which, in all the models that have been studied, measures the intrinsic uncertainty caused by the specified information. General theorems tell us when non-adaptive, that is, parallel information, is just as powerful as adaptive information. There are many other theoretical results You'll be relieved to know I'm not going to report them now. Our goal is also to apply the general theory to solving specific problems in varied areas, and I'm going to give you one small example, image understanding. John Tender has been working with a PhD student, David Lee, in applying the general framework of information-based complexity to problems in image understanding systems, such as the vision example I introduced earlier. For that problem, they are seeking answers to the six general questions that I posed earlier in the talk. They plan to use the framework of information-based complexity to attack other image understanding problems, such as shape from shading and optical flow in robotic vision, as well as medical imaging examples. As you've been listening, a question that might have occurred to you concerns the relation between information-based complexity and concepts of information and entropy as developed in thermodynamics by Boltzmann and Clausius and information theory by Shannon. Our questions are not posed nor answered by either thermodynamics or information theory, the latter having been motivated by problems arising in communication, not computation. Furthermore, information, in the sense of Shannon, is defined to be a certain number, the information content of the message, certainly not the information in the message. Now, there are connections between certain notions of entropy and some of our work on information. Vyshnikovsky and I have reported on the relation between Kolmogorov's notion of epsilon entropy and our second question on how much information is needed to limit the uncertainty to a specified level. And we're pursuing ideas on other connections. I've said that if the information is complete and exact, then in principle, the problem can be solved exactly. If the information is partially contaminated, there's inherent uncertainty. Well, it's a third category that might have occurred to you, and that's extremely important. You might be able to solve the problem exactly, but choose not to, because the exact solution is simply too expensive. You choose to live with uncertainty in order to decrease complexity. In Herbert Simon's phrase, you satisfice rather than optimize. Examples are provided by the heuristics of artificial intelligence, the use of random algorithms as pioneered by Rabin, and various techniques for the approximate solution of NP-complete problems. Uncertainty-complexity trade-offs are a rich and important subject upon which we've written elsewhere. I promised to address three great themes. The first was complexity, a fundamental invariant of computer science. I've discussed the important role that invariants play in science generally and why I find the newcomer, computational complexity, so interesting. The second theme was information, its power and limitations. I've introduced you to a new level of abstraction called the information level, which allows us to think generally about problems with partial and contaminated information. Finally, I promise to address the role of generality and simplicity in science, a role whose significance most of you already know. Our aim in information-based complexity is to find unity across a great variety of what seem at first totally different disciplines, and there we've made a beginning.
Thank you very much, Joe, for the lovely lecture. I can see stimulation and questions. I invite you all to ask whatever questions you want at a reception right now in the faculty room, which is located right behind this stage. Joe will be there, and I'm sure he'll be able to answer anything you want. Good night.